I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I've got one word to say to you.
Look at me.
G'day. I'm Rowdy Walden and welcome to Look at Me, the podcast. Join me and a myriad of special acquaintances as we celebrate the hilarious Kath and Kim. Unofficially, of course. It's going to be...
Yeah, it's nice. It's different. It's unusual.
That's right. Let's get into it. Oh, here we are, season four already. Can you bloody believe it? On this episode, to talk about Yuma, comedian and one of the funniest television writers I know, Zoe Norton-Lodge is going to be joining me. But first, the highlight of this podcast, please enjoy another earworm from the maestro, Gabby Bolt.
It's the Kath and Kim season four musical recap. And can I just say, it's been a lot of fun to make these. Sharon gets accused of ball tampering. Kel bashes Eric Banner's face in and Kim becomes a cosmetic surgeon. Sharon and Kim go on Deal or No Deal. Kath thinks she might be Aboriginal. Kel is related to Jennifer Aniston. Sharon's mean half-sister comes to visit. And Sharon is also really horny in this season. She ends up sleeping with Brett, but marries a Shane Warne impersonator called Wayne. Kath and Kel turn the house into a B&B and Kim owes $90,000 in overdue DVDs. Whew, that one was a bit of a tongue twister.
Thank you for coming on my silly little Kath and Kim podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You recently rewatched it just for this, didn't you?
I did. I was like, I love Kath and Kim so much, but I've got this really terrible memory. I'll watch it, enjoy it so much, be obsessed with it, and then like the details always just kind of evaporate. So I really wanted to rewatch it and I was not disappointed. It was so, so funny.
I think I've banged on every week about how much I think that this is like the premium example of Australian comedy and like the puns, but also the jokes around the outfits they're wearing, the way the show's written, the way the show's filmed. And everyone has sort of echoed the same sentiment as me, but there's something to it, isn't it, as a comedy series?
There really is something special about it. And I've been trying to put my finger on, you know, what I think it is. What is that alchemy? What's that fusion of things that just makes it so perfect?
Yeah.
And I think it's actually a mix of the completely familiar and the completely unfamiliar. The setting, the types, the tropes, the characters, the events, the small and big happenings, they're all stuff we've seen before. They're all kind of almost cliche Aussie suburban life. The way they talk is familiar. However, it is so unique. Like every set of three words together, I've never heard together before. It creates this sort of like alternate version of English, which is at once so accessible and understandable and says so much about them and is so relatable and yet is so odd and unusual and feels like something I've never heard before. I think that's a real gift.
Yeah. This might be throwing shade at you and I as people who write telly, but I don't think we make TV like this anymore.
No.
Or we certainly don't have this sense of humour when it comes to TV anymore.
No, I think that's right. Like you certainly haven't seen anything approaching Kath and Kim. Well, I certainly haven't gotten the same joy out of watching a show recently as I did out of watching Kath and Kim.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's one of those things where there's so many possible reasons for that. And I really don't think it has anything to do with the quality of comedians and writers around the place. Not just saying that to make us feel better, Rowdy, but I actually don't. As you and I know from working, you know, in the sausage factory of TV, there are just so many things that can go right and can go terribly wrong when making a show. And as I'm sure you know, Kath and Kim almost didn't happen.
Yeah, right. So tell me that story.
From what I understand, so we know Kath and Kim evolved out of, you know, characters that they performed on their sketch show, Big Girls Blouse, much earlier in the 90s. They evolved this kind of idea for a TV show and it was actually rejected by ABC Comedy. And when you hear that, it sounds so bizarre because it feels like such a no-brainer, such a winner. But we know that because we've seen the final result. There are things about it that, and I'm just speculating here. I don't know. I've got no idea what happened, but I can imagine the absurdity of the language, the silliness of it, the kind of mundanity of it, maybe the fact that it was so female driven might have put off people. I don't know. But of course, it was commissioned then by ABC Drama, which just shows you that, you know, I've worked at the ABC forever and I have absolutely no idea how it works.
ABC Drama?
Yeah, that's what I understand. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Because I've told this story a few times on this podcast, but I remember watching it for the first time as a 10-year-old and thinking that it was real.
Yeah, wow. What made you think it was real?
Well, it was that mockumentary style.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you don't watch the opening titles, you know, it's got that sort of crash zoom into when someone talks. Sharon comes in the back door. It all sort of felt like my life.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost filmed like, you know, the Kardashians or something. Like, it's got exactly that sort of, yeah, reality TV vibe. And I guess, you know, maybe that put people off as well. Like, it feels so, you know, Kath and Kim feels like home and it feels so quintessential and like something that belongs to us and that reflects us. But it is so fascinating to think that it almost never happened because the powers that be didn't necessarily understand that at the time.
Do you think maybe there was an element to it as well that Australian comedy TV seems to sort of go in fads? Like, before Kath and Kim, I might be wrong, but it felt like it was all sketch shows.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you can't get a sketch show up to save yourself anymore.
I also don't think there's any appetite for sketch shows. Like, we've had a handful in the last, you know, 20 years that haven't really found an audience or made the same impact as, you know, Frontline or Big Girls Blouse did. But we seem to have a lot of scripted comedy series. Like, maybe there's just something in our sort of personal taste as a society.
Well, it's interesting because who would really know? It's really, really hard, I think, to unpack whether something reflects the tastes of society or the risk assessment of the people who make TV.
Like,
who knows? I think one thing that is really special about Kath and Kim that you can really tell is it feels auteured. It feels like those people made that show. It feels like they weren't interfered with too much. They were allowed to do what they wanted. And I think when you think about shows that are really special, like Fleabag, for example, is probably, you might argue, has a similar impact, but it's so her. You can tell it's one person's vision. And I really think that we underestimate the high caliber of content that you can get if you really put your trust in someone. Even if you're like, this sounds odd, I don't get it, but I trust you. You believe in this. I think this is going to be amazing. And I think that the risk averse position is to interfere, to dumb things down, to make things more accessible, quote unquote, whatever that means. But yeah, I think Kath and Kim is really a story of persistence and also people just wanting to stick it to the man a little bit and be like, we're going to write a story about the silliest women who we adore.
I think you're right on that note as well, because like just thinking on that point, like there's Fleabag, but there's also Chewing Gum, which are like, and Kath and Kim, you could almost put them all in the same bag as like very specific shows with very specific identities that you probably wouldn't think that a show like Fleabag or Chewing Gum would find like a mass global audience. And yet it did.
Exactly. Because I think people do underestimate an audience. And also because, frankly, a lot of it is unknown factors and luck of the draw. Like, it's easy to say that, of course, Fleabag was going to be a success. Of course, Kath and Kim was going to be a success. Look how good they are. But it's very, very difficult to have a crystal ball to know, A, that that's going to happen, and B, that people are going to love it. You know, I've seen the odd show where I've watched it and been like, this is phenomenal, and I've never heard anyone talk about it. I also think, just on that, I think that Kath and Kim, which, you know, finished in about, was it 2007?
Yeah.
Kind of heralded from a slightly different era of TV where you really could become like a megastar by being on a show.
Being on TV once a week.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas nowadays, viewing is so dissipated.
So fragmented, yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know that you really get that anymore. Even for massive shows, like massive, massive, massive shows that we think everyone watches, they don't. Like, it's easy to find people who, you know, have never watched The Sopranos or The Wire or Succession. Like, plenty of people haven't watched them.
Just because it's fresh in your mind, is there a moment from season four that you love as a comedy writer or just love as a person with a sense of humor?
There are so many moments. Like, one thing I just think is so inspired is having Shane Warne be a Shane Warne impersonator.
Yeah, yeah.
And mack on with Sharon and ultimately marry her. It's just, what a divine idea. I guess by season four, you see that joy of the fact that they are so established. I think they're back on Channel 7 at that point. They've got money behind them. And, you know, there's like Kel's purveyor of fine meats, little butcher stand. like he has that intern who's, you know,
Katie,
has all these
Katie
gourmet ideas, Katie. Yeah. And like you turn around and there's just this like one shot with, and all the customers are the most famous chefs and restaurateurs in the land. And yeah. you're like, it's amazing to think, like when you make TV, to imagine being like, can you get like, you know, everyone who's anyone in food, Maggie Beer, Kylie Kwong, everyone
yeah.
down for this one shot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was funny though that like it sort of did seem to peak in season four, but then it never came back. Like it was a weird way to leave the series, I think.
The marriage. I mean, I think.
Well, even just like not just the marriage, but like it being such a big deal and a big cult following with like all of the, you know, suddenly it's definitely in the fabric of Australia and then it just ended.
I mean, that's so interesting as well, isn't it? You never know, like, well, I mean, I guess as somebody would know, but there's probably a million reasons for it. Maybe they never needed to work again. Maybe they wanted to do other things.
They'd made so much money.
Oh, my
like,
God. I mean, I hope they never needed to work again. I mean, I just don't know. Like, like sometimes really popular shows don't get another season. And, yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about Kath and Kim is, like, it might have ended, but it is so still in the consciousness.
And has, as a comedy, has not dated.
No, it hasn't dated. I think they deal with some things in an interesting, in a way that like wouldn't be dealt with now, which I think is quite interesting because, you know, it 2007 is a lot has happened since 2007. And do you remember the episode where Kath thinks she's Indigenous?
Yes, it's my favourite.
And joins Bangara and is doing this dance with Stephen Page. And it is so funny. And I think done in such a beautiful spirit. And Kim is completely racist in the episode because she has gotten all bogged down with, I think she's watching, Current Affair or something like that. But it's just like the issues are tackled in a really interesting way. And I mean, when I say the issues are tackled, they're not really tackled. It's just kind of a comedy. But I feel like even those areas are like too dangerous to paddle in for comedy now.
Yeah. Well, it's also, there are other comedies of that time that you watch back and you just think, holy fucking shit, that's not funny anymore.
Yeah.
And why did we think that was okay at the time? But it's not the same when you watch Kath and Kim, and maybe it's the way that it's written or...
I think that's right. And I think part of it is the spirit of it and the intention of it and what you gain from it. Like you learn, it's very clear that Kim is wrong and an idiot in the show, you know, when she's espousing stupid things, and they're always countermanded by Kath, who disagrees with her at every turn. That just reminded me of like one of the funniest lines. I mean, there's so many funny lines, but one thing that just really struck me was there's a moment when they're on, I think it's episode one, and they're going on the holiday and like it's supposed to be the honeymoon. Yeah, Kath and Kellen, everyone tag along, and there's a fight. Kellen's up squirting Brett with sunscreen, like he's trying to shoo him away. Like Kath runs away. They think Kath is missing. Kel finds one of her earrings, a little bird earring. When they're all reunited, he says, "Oh, I found that parrot earring. That's how I knew it was yours." And she's like, "It's not mine. That's a cassowary. I've never been able to wear cassowaries. I've got a square face." What the
it's
hell?
So silly. It's so silly.
And the moment that I was just thinking is, you know, from a comedy writing and a TV making perspective, just before that, so they when they eventually find Kath, she's been in the gift shop the entire time. Like she's been missing all day, but she's been gift shopping all day in the little shop. And she like has all these, she's at a gift shop and she has all these bags and she's pulling out objects and she's commenting on them like, a stone with googly eyes for like X person. This is a pig with blah. Every object she pulls out is hilarious. And it's going to a hilarious place. It's all very funny. But I was watching it thinking, like, they didn't make those objects for this scene. I reckon they went to a gift shop, picked them all out, and then kind of went from there.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, as someone that's very recently been to a resort, I can confirm that they're still being sold in gift shops in resorts.
Yeah, absolutely. And just that they knew, like they would have known as writers, oh, there's going to be this kind of dinky stuff in the gift shop. We'll just get it and we'll figure it out on the fly.
Do you think that like it would have had the same you know, you hear this like writer's room thing about TV series, but do you think it would have had the same thing, or it was just them, the three of them writing whatever silly thing they could have thought of?
I mean, I don't know what their process was, but Gina Riley and Jane Turner are always credited as the writers, and Magda's credited with originating the character of Sharon Strzelecki. And I'm sure, like, I would assume Magda would have been involved because, like, they come from a sketch background. So I think you write and then you kind of maybe improvise a little bit. But I definitely get the sense that it was authored by them, that it was basically those two. And whether or not there were others involved, it is so clearly their vision. And I think that came out of a determination that came from working for so long in, before Big Girls Blast, working for so long in sketch comedies that were incredibly male driven in a world that really didn't think women were all that funny. And it's really hard, I think, to be funny when you're kind of in an environment that, even if they respect you as a performer and they think you can, you know, be a clown, they don't necessarily respect your brain and your ideas and your capacity to invent and originate, or if they think it's funny, they don't necessarily kind of take that extra leap and be like, okay, cool, we're putting millions of dollars behind it and we're going to actually let you do you. You know, I don't know for certain, you know, I wasn't there. I've got no idea, but I get the impression from a couple of things I've read that sort of knowing they lived in a man's world, like comedy was a man's world. If they were going to do it, they had to be determined. They had to never give up, and they stayed really true to who they were. And I think maybe like that success in the face of, you know, rejection is like so powerful. And then I think once you actually have that success, and as soon as it would have, like, the early seasons, I think, rated their socks off. You know, it was popular from the get-go.
Yeah.
And it was like, must have been like, I can't imagine how validating that would have been for them to be like, after all this time, people do love us. We are smart. We're geniuses.
We are funny. Yeah.
Yeah. And like now you look back and you're like, if you think of like, you know, comic geniuses in Australia, those three 100% are probably the first that come to mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think like it on the first season won the time slot. And then by the second season, it had won the title of like the most watched, or, you know, breaking the records for a comedy series. And 20 years on is still making people laugh and making waves, like with its, you know, addition to Netflix and finding a new audience, and people like you rewatching it, and people like me who have been watching it this entire time on DVD.
Yeah. Oh my God. It was like, I was so thrilled to like the second I sat down, you know, obviously everything feels like homework for a second. I guess I better watch the season. Within like three frames, I was like, yes, I like cracked open chocolate biscuits. This is like at 9 o'clock last night. I was like scarfing them, watching, just having a ball. It was like so much fun. Another thing that spun me out watching it last night, where I almost did a spit take, was when Kel has won Fountain Lake Retailer of the Year or whatever, and he's going to all these VIP events, like to show up, be a famous face or whatever. And he's, I think, at a train station or something. And Eric Banner shows up. And for a second, I was so spun out, because sometimes it's really a trip out to me when comedians who, like actors who work with other actors, in the same thing, but one of them is playing a character, one of them is playing themselves. So it's like, they're not from completely different worlds, are they? Like Jane Turner, Glenn Robbins, and Eric Banner. And also because there were other cameos in that same episode, like Rob Sitch was in the couple of scenes before, but playing a character. And then suddenly Eric Banner was there. And I just thought it was like, just so funny and stupid that Eric Banner is just Eric Banner.
And also cements this idea that Kath and Kim is a part of us.
Mm.
Of course they exist in the same time and space as Eric Banner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the engagement with the culture at the time, you know, just like every time they're watching TV and commenting on it, you know, them going on Deal or No Deal, like everything is just like, I was reading an article where they were addressing that it was problematic because it was classist or whatever. And I think, and they just totally dismissed it, which I personally agree with, because I think it is a love letter to suburban Australia. And I think anyone Absolutely. Who sees it as anything else is looking for something to be a problem.
Was it the first show that was like headed by two females? It's hard to think of other examples, but maybe that's just because I'm like, you know, have a big crush on Kath and Kim.
I mean, look, I don't know if it was literally the first show to be kind of created by two women or not, but it was certainly the first kind of narrative comedy that I can recall that was headed up in that way. I mean, but if you think about the UK, if you think about Ab Fab and French and Saunders and things, it's like there was kind of a sort of, we had a template
yeah,
that it fucking works. Letting two women or three women or whatever just get together and just be as stupid as they want and be just totally uninformed by the male gaze. It sounds so kind of trite now. And I think obviously we've moved so far on to far more important elements of, you know, identity politics and representation. However, I do think that for women back in the 90s and stuff, finally getting an opportunity to do comedy by themselves and not be guided by or informed by what guys thought, it just made it funnier. Like women are actually funnier, I think.
It's also not a show about two women.
No.
Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I think maybe that sort of is where it maybe got held up, is that people probably thought it was going to be a show about a mum and a daughter, but it's really not. It's about, you know, the mundane suburban life.
Oh, absolutely. It's just that it's made by two women, which means that you're seeing it in a way you haven't seen it before.
Yeah.
You know, it's just fun and silly and it kind of feels different and special because I think by the very nature of the fact there hadn't been many shows like that by women in Australia, it was fresh. Like they got that chance to do it. Like no one was really doing it.
Why do you think that the jokes have survived?
Oh, I think the jokes survive because they are so unique. They're not derivative at all. There was one moment like where Kim was flinging dog shit around and dog shit landed on like a, you know, a Lilo in their garden. And Kath was like, Kim, that's bad feng pooey. I'm like, no one's ever said that before. No one's ever said that before. It's almost like at that high level of when people create a fantasy world, like, you know, Lord of the Rings or something, and they create whole vernaculars and dialects and things like that. It had that granular level of uniqueness. And I think when something is genuinely so original and comes from such a spirited place of like love and careful observation, and yet is also just frivolous and fun, and you've never heard it before, but you think you have, I think that is why they last. They're so familiar and they hit you, but you've never heard them before.
Yeah. When the joke feels like it could have been your mum or your sister.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to like, when I think about the humor in Kath and Kim, it's like so much of those jokes are still said.
Yeah.
Like even you, when you were like, oh, I had to rewatch it to sort of get back into the mind frame. But I reckon if you hadn't have watched it and I had pressed you on it, you use more of the Kath and Kim vernacular and you know more of the references than you think you know, because it's so much a part of us now.
Absolutely. It's kind of like The Simpsons in that way. Like, I grew up watching The Simpsons, and because I watched it from the age of about six when it was in its absolute heyday, there are so many things that I learnt in retrospect were actually parodies in The Simpsons, but I'd learnt the parody first.
I'd
be like, oh, that barbershop quartet is a real thing. Oh, this is actually about the Beatles. This is actually about this person.
One of the jokes in Kath and Kim, that's that exact point that I talk about all the time, is that there's one moment in the series where Kim is so hungry. She says, oh, I've got to eat something. I'm about to go into ketosis.
Ketosis.
Keto diets didn't come into trend until like 5 years ago.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I used to make that joke and laugh about it, having no idea what it was. And then all of a sudden, like the keto diet is the latest fad.
Wow. So like they were ahead of the curve with fad diets. I mean, but that doesn't tell you everything. Of course they were ahead of the curve with fad diets. It's the only thing those ladies were ahead of the curve with.
Well, Celine Cuisine.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. Have you heard the rumor that there's like a reboot circling?
No.
Oh, so you saw the house has been demolished, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did, yeah.
But like, so the same week that that all came out, there was like, ooh, Kath and Kim might be coming back. And obviously I got super excited. And I am happy to die on the hill that, you know, I think that the Sex and the City reboot is actually quite good, because as a show, well, as a hear me out.
Okay, I'm trying to listen. Rowdy, that's the funniest thing's been said this whole episode.
I'm listening. It didn't come back and try and be Sex and the City. For all its faults, yes, it came back and it tried to be more woke and whatever, and it really struggled at that. It didn't come back and try and be the sort of, you know, Sex in the City, couple of single girls fucking their way around New York. Like it had moved on and it had picked up at a much more interesting place in their lives, I think. And yes, there were moments where it sort of got really shit and too woke and whatever. But if Kath and Kim were to come back, where do you think it would pick up as a comedy writer? I can see a version where it sort of picks up in a Fleabag style from Epony at university or something. Like, you know, like as Muriel's Wedding, the musical sort of revamped the story of Muriel.
That's so interesting. I almost think if they did it, I'd want it to be exactly the same. I want to be like, you know what? I believe that Fountain Lakes hasn't changed. I believe they're still all living in the same house. I believe Kel has a few more trophies. He's won Best Retailer of Fountain Lakes another couple of times. They've bought and sold Mandy's house. Sharon's had a few more weddings. But I just don't you, isn't part of the joy of it that you just get this sense that it is a part of, it's like a little black dress. It's just timeless. And I think their world is timeless. I think their relationships are timeless. I think that capturing of suburbia, like I truly think if you went to a Fountain Lake type place, it might still feel like it was a few decades ago.
Babe, I'm from Dubbo. I know. Arana Mall's had a makeover, but nothing's changed.
Well, that's it. I mean, that would be the fun thing to be like, for them to think, be like, oh my God, look how much has changed. And it's like, nothing has changed.
Nothing. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's a really interesting take. And it'd be interesting to see if like people still gravitated towards the show if it was just the same.
Another thing that's really hard is that like, part of the reason people might not want it to come back is there's nothing sadder than seeing Ricky Gervais roll out his Brent character in like, you know, film and after film. And it's just like, oh, The Office was great. Just move on. Like, just stop. Pens down. And I think some comedians really need to know when to be like, you know, okay, I'm actually not funny anymore. And, you know, like I'm 37 and when I go and see a comedy show now, I'm so like delighted at seeing comedians who are 10, 15 years younger than me and be like, you are so funny. My brain would never do that. I wouldn't think that way. I just couldn't even conjure that as a concept. But like, it's always the fear that something that was so perfect and so classic is going to come back and it's going to just really fucking disappoint you and it'll slightly sour the entire thing. But I actually have faith in them. I think they're so funny. And I think if they just kept doing what they were doing, I reckon it's worth the risk.
Thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything that I've missed that you want to talk about?
No, I mean, I just think like, thank you for giving me a reason to binge watch season 4 of Kath and Kim and eat like these ludicrous chocolate biscuits that my sister's mother-in-law made. I had a really great night. So thank you.
You're so welcome. I'm glad I can enable that for people. And that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Please hit follow if you want to be notified for future episodes, which obviously you do. And if you can be bothered taking time out of your very busy schedule, chuck us a review. 5 stars, please. I'm Reddy Walden, and you'll be hearing from me next week. Hooroo.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.